she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy, darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, a fun and informative place where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to one of our amazing partners, Habitat for Humanity Tucson. They really do build homes, communities, and hope, both in our community and as part of their international commitment to end homelessness. These people are the real deal. They are truly creating a more compassionate and just world. Thank you, Habitat, for your support of Mrs. Green's World and for your commitment to end homelessness all around the globe. You rock. So let's get things started because we have another great guest who will be speaking with us this next hour. Please join me in welcoming Simran Sethi. Simran is a journalist and an educator and all that. She's like a lot. Let's just say we could spend half the time just reading about her excellent adventures in her life. But she has focused on food, sustainability, and social change. She was named the Environmental Messenger by Vanity Fair, a top 10 eco hero of the planet by UK's Independent, and designated one of the top 8 women saving the planet by Marie Claire. Simran is the author of the award-winning book that we are going to talk about, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of the Foods We Love. Simran, a warm, sincere, fun, hot, hip, and happening welcome for you being here.
Well, a juicy and delicious welcome to you, Gina.
I said, we're going to have to try to behave on this. I mean, the things that I said off air, I might weave into the conversation, but this book is the first sentence in the book. You talk about you had me from hello. This is a book about food, but it's really a book about love. And then it's really a book about taste, and it's really a book about your very own story, and it's a book about slowing down and being and loving this place you're in, especially when you're eating. So there was just no downside for me, especially with some of the topics you covered. But I guess where I want to start with the question is, why should people listening to the show take the time to soak everything that you're going to share with us in, not just because the book is really that good, and it is, but the underpinning for me is that this book is one we really need to be paying attention to. If we want to have hope, if we want to be part of the change, what's at stake for all of us? Why should people tune up their listening skills?
Gosh, you're hitting on so many things I want to respond to all at once. I'm glad we're at the top of the show. I'll start by saying the book is about the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And what that is the loss of diversity in every element that makes food possible. So from a loss of diversity in the soil to a loss of diversity in seeds, in pollinators. Many of your listeners may be familiar with colony collapse disorder and the loss of honeybees,
right.
But this moves on through the food chain to plants, to animals, to aquatic life. And, you know, I consider myself someone who's pretty on top of information about the environment and about food. And I was so stunned that I had knew about endangered species, but I didn't realize that our food was at risk. And that's what inspired me to quit. I was a tenured associate professor at the University of Kansas. I couldn't get fired. I guess I could have if I tried really hard, but I didn't want to.
You would have done something really bad.
Really bad. But I when I found out about this, I was in Italy doing research for a completely different subject for a fellowship that I'd been nominated for. And scientists kept saying, you know, Simran, what we care about is the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And the back of my head, I was like, what? I don't know what you're talking about. And this is now going on about 6 years ago. Once I understood what was at stake. I quit my job, I sold my house, I gave away my car, and I embarked on a five-year journey across six continents to better understand what that loss meant. And I ultimately decided to tell the story through foods that I love, which is bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer, which I grew to love. And it was really with the intention of saying, map this onto whatever you love, because nothing is immune. No food, no deliciousness is immune from what is about to happen. And what is about to happen is we're losing diversity. And why that matters is with all the variability, all the changes that we see, ranging from climate change to changing foods to globalization, changing tastes, you know, to trade agreements, to industrialization. I mean, there's a host of reasons why, you know, our diets change over time. But every single one of those are leading to a scenario where the peak of the food pyramid is about as fine as Seattle's Space Needle. And why this matters, why this there's urgency around caring about this is this increases risk. So if you think about it this way, if you were, like, if you had some money to invest, there's no financial advisor who would say, hey, Gina, put it all in two stocks and you'll be good for the rest of your life. That's just not good risk management. But when it comes to food, we are growing fewer varieties. We are eating fewer varieties. 3/4 of our food now comes from 12 plant and 5 animal species. And about 95% of our calories comes from just 30 species. And that means that we're losing the kind of diversity that we could fall back on if one crop failed. We would need the diversity to breed in new traits. We would need the diversity to be more resilient to climate change. We would need the diversity to combat disease. But instead, what we're doing is exactly the opposite. You know, what industrialization calls for is a one-size-fits-all answer. And that's what the food and agriculture industry are doing. And, you know, right now we're okay, but this is a real perilous way to, you know, ensure food security in the future.
And it's just, like, sitting here, I'm soaking it up. And when you said your five-year journey, no wonder it took me hours and hours and hours to prepare for the show, because I'm like, I've got to ask her about that. No, I've got to ask her about this. No, I've got to ask her about that. But what I decided to do, this is what came to me when I was prepping for the show. It's like there are a lot of what I call BAMs in this book. I love Emeril, and I love it when he goes, BAM. And a BAM for me, which they're always good, is you have to tell everybody about Luigi Guarino and his explanation that seeds are sex. And this is what I mean. I said to you, your book is like the eat, pray, love of substance. And I love that book. I don't have anything bad to say about
too.
It.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to the message of this. I mean, who didn't want to be in Eat, Pray, Love? Who didn't want to be Julia Roberts and do everything she did? But what you have done is taken the excitement of that, the importance of that, and added into a beautifully told story. So through the people that you met on your journey. So tell us about Luigi. I want to meet Luigi.
Absolutely. Well, I'll back up and say, just to the point of Eat, Pray, Love, that really was Elizabeth Gilbert's journey. And this is absolutely the story, bread, wine, chocolate, the slow loss of food we love is my journey, but it's really a universal
yes,
one.
Yes, it is.
I'm just the person who got to get on the plane, you know? So it wasn't, it's not like you're learning. I mean, you learn that, I smoked cigarettes in Kansas when my heart was broken. but it's not, you know, heartbreak is a universal phenomenon. Hunger, craving, desire, all these things are things that I think we can all tap into. And for me, when I was writing the book, I really thought, like, okay, well, people like Luigi are going to, they're going to share their stories and they will be the connective, like the emotional connection of the book. Every time I'd send pages to my colleague Kim and to my editor Gideon, they'd say, yeah, how about more of you? To the point where I'd send back in capital letters, like, no.
Right.
I'm not giving you me. This isn't about me. This was never about me. But what it ended up being was, hopefully, if I did this right, I'm the lens through which you get to experience the place where chocolate comes from, the fields where coffee is grown, the grape vineyards in California. Like, if you're not going to be able to get on a plane and get there, I'm going to bring it to you to the best of my ability. And so I hope that people will be able to step in my
you
shoes.
Did,
and
you did,
feel
you did,
those
you did. I want to ring the bell and say,
oh,
you
thank
did.
You. Thank you.
I said to
well,
you.
Well, I'm so grateful.
I said to you off air, there were parts of it, and I'm going to bring those up where I'm reading it, and they were sensual and they were intimate and they were, it was almost like I said, okay, maybe I shouldn't be reading this. And I mean that in the highest compliment. It was like your soul bared open. This is what happened. But, you know, when you get down to the substance of Luigi, tell us what he taught you in the beginning of your
journey. Luigi Guarino, he's a senior scientist at the Global Crop Diversity Trust. The Crop Trust is best known as being the custodian, the financial custodian of the Svalbard seed vault in, it's halfway between Norway and the Arctic Circle. So it's the doomsday vault. It's the place where we hold all the backup collections of seeds, or at least we try to, in the world. And it was recently accessed for the first time as Syria has tried to access, Syria accessed wheat to try to rebuild their seed bank, which has now been relocated to Lebanon as a result of the civil war. So I sat down when I was doing preliminary research. I really wanted to meet Carrie Fowler. Carrie has written, you know, extraordinary books on agricultural biodiversity. He helped co-found the Doomsday Vault, and he's one of my personal heroes. And, you know, he invited into the meeting this Italian scientist, Luigi Guarino, who ended up being, like, one of the strongest sources for the book. He really vetted all the science, you know, when appropriate for the sections that related to him, and, you know, to the point where I told him I was going to dedicate the book to him, and I did. So what he said to me on first meeting, though, I will tell you, which is what I wrote in the book, he was really skeptical. You know, he's this, you know, very, like, nicely dressed Italian man sitting in an office. There's Carrie. Carrie's from Nashville, Tennessee. You know, we have a southern connection. I grew up in North Carolina. You know, so I was feeling, like, Carrie's energy was quite affable. Luigi was kind of leaned back. And I handed them my business cards, and, you know, they're from KU. And I think Luigi probably stared at it for a nanosecond. I don't know what Carrie did with it. And then Luigi started to pick his teeth with it. And I just thought,
are you kidding me?
Oh, hi. You know, and then I'm sort of explaining to them, oh, my, you know, I wanted to write a book on seeds, but my editor thought seeds weren't sexy enough. And he kind of, like, just juts in right at that moment. He's like, Simran, seeds are sex. And I just, in that moment, was like, oh, my God, of course seeds are sex. Of course they're little sex packets. And so, you know, I went on to do, I went on to give a TEDx talk in Manhattan that where I talk about Luigi again, and it's dedicated to seeds. But what the book became was, you know, seeds were just the start of what the book became. And so for me, Luigi and another gentleman named Stefano Padlosi, who's a senior scientist at Bioversity International, an NGO that's really focused on farm conservation of crop biodiversity. He's known as Rocket Man, because rocket is another word for arugula. And Stefano has managed to save some of the wild arugula that exists in the world, so from being destroyed. So he's pretty extraordinary in his own right. And these two gentlemen really helped turn the ship on what my book would become, because they helped me recognize how critically important seeds were, how critically important agricultural biodiversity was, when I was looking at, you know, much more granular kind of issues and not the big picture.
You know, did you feel as you were writing the book that it was just such a blessed journey? And I mean that in every sense of the word, that you were put in front of the right people at the right time with the most compelling stories, knowledgeable, full of substance, fun, somebody that says seeds are sex. It's like, you gotta love it. So did you feel in this 5-year journey that every time you turned a corner, the right things were happening so that you could make such an important statement through your book?
You know, I think, Gina, that's such a compelling question. Not all of it. It was a tough journey. It's hard to go to places that you don't know and enter into situations. I'm a 5-foot-tall Indian woman. You know, I didn't always know what I was getting myself into, but you know, I know you know this too, because you already described it. It's the BAM moments. It's when you're sitting in an interview and you know something magical just happened. And trust me, I mean, I interviewed over 200 people. The number of people in the book are probably closer to like 50. So one out of four was the BAM. You know, so not everything was quite that, but it can't be. But when it was pretty darn magical. And I think it was a combination of a lot of grace and a lot of support from my colleague Kim Sherman and from, you know, my editor Gideon Weil, who never stopped, neither of them ever stopped believing in me. You know, so basically I'd pitched one book, you know, HarperCollins had approached me and asked me would I write a book. I was in the middle of doing a lot of broadcast journalism around environmentalism and got all those nice accolades you mentioned at the top of the show. And I was like, well, I'm not a writer. I'm not ready to write a book, blah, blah, blah. And so they bought one idea, but they let it evolve into this other thing. So I had this book contract for 7 years, and they never gave up on me. When I said, I'll give you the advance back, like, I can't do this. You know, the head of the publishing division, the imprint, Harper One, said, we just want you to write a book. And so they let me write the book I wanted to write. And for that, I'm extraordinarily grateful. And so there was that coupled with, you know, my support system in Kim in particular, who really helped me make it all happen. You know, she was on the ground in Kansas, like making those phone calls to try to set up interviews at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, Ethiopia standard time, to get somebody on the phone, you know. And then if we couldn't get someone on the phone, I just showed up and kind of winged it, you know. I mean, but it was really, it was a team effort. You know, my name's on the front of the book, but it was the grace of the gods, and it was also this, the grace of the real genuine people who, you know, who fought tooth and nail for the book and who worked their, you know, their tushy off to help make it happen.
Right.
So, and the brilliance of the people. I mean, my gosh, I shouldn't overlook this. Every one of those 200 people gave me their time, you know, and they gave me their energy. And I'm indebted to all of them, especially the ones who didn't end up in the book, because it's awfully hard to give somebody your time and then not get the glory of your name in print. You know, I've been on the, you know, the giving end of that too. So I'm really grateful for all the people who helped shape it and make it come together.
And what you did, I mean, in this journey, by no means is just a romantic story of, you know, seeds or sex. I mean, I could feel the pain, mm-hmm. the discovery, even the information that was coming to you is rather mm-hmm. daunting. It can be depressing, challenging, the places that you went. But let's talk about loss, because I think this, like, front and center, another bam. Every historic fruit and vegetable variety once found in the United States, it said nearly every, has disappeared.
Yeah.
So we had 1,000 varieties of bananas grown in the world, and we get one. 7,500 varieties of apples. And how many will you get in the grocery store, like 20 or 30? What's up with
gosh,
that?
Gosh, I don't know what grocery store you're going to, lady. Yeah, I get like 5.
If you're lucky. I mean, it's like maybe if you go to some, you know, weird grocery stores in L.A. where they have a lot more choices, but who's deciding what we grow and what not to grow? Why is this happening? That's a big disappearing number from 1,000 to 1.
Right. And it's disempowering, right? Like, well, if you don't know what's happening, then you can't work towards solving the problem. But what I really try to do is say, this is what's going on, guys, but it hasn't always been this way. And we the eaters can help transform this. You know, we've both been talking about environmental issues for a long time, Gina, and there are times when the bottom line answer seems to be something like, contact your elected official.
You know? Yes.
Which feels like the most heartbreaking, especially in this political environment. It often feels like one of the most heartbreaking responses. I feel I'm rendered impotent when I'm told, like, write my elected official. But, you know, if I'm told eat differently, eat better, savor what's out there, go to the farmer's market, you know, I can do these things, and I will do them with joy, because this isn't like the distant kind of change your light bulb or pick up a reusable bag. Like, I don't, you know, maybe it's just me, but I don't get a lot of, like, joy out of those things. I don't dislike them,
but
there's nothing tangible or juicy. But I'm saying, like, twirl it around on your fork, you know, stick it in your mouth, like, enjoy this.
Savor
feast.
It comes to mind.
Poem.
Savor
exactly.
It. Yeah.
Savor. And you know, so here's the thing. I said at the beginning of the show, this is what agricultural biodiversity is. It's the loss of diversity in every component that makes food possible. But here's how we save it. We save it in three primary ways, according to conservationists. We save it ex situ, which means it's Latin for out of place. So it's like a seed bank, like what I just referenced in Svalbard. But there are seed banks all over the world. There are other kinds of plant and animal banks. They're called germplasm repositories. So I went, for example, to the wine, you know, the place where they save the table grapes and wine grapes in Davis, California. So we don't grow grapes from seed. We grow them, you know, from the vine. So all the vines are saved and all the grapes are withered, because that's not what they're trying to conserve, right? Or they're places that have, you know, zoos are an example, or can be an example, certainly, of preserving animal biodiversity. So that's one way we save them. We also save agricultural biodiversity in situ, which is Latin for in place. We say that in situ in the wild, which is by saving the wild places where plants right. and animals are raised or grow. And that is the place where we also save what are called the crop wild relatives of the plants that we love. So it would be like the crazy, you know, cousin three times removed that is related to you, but not exactly like you. Well, you have enough in common that, you know, there might be, you might need a liver transplant from that guy, right? Or we might need to breed in the traits of, let's say, drought tolerance that we right. find in a wild variety of coffee that we're going to need in order to save the coffee that we love, which is largely Arabica coffee. We also save it in situ on farm. So that is, we save it by growing it. So my best example, of course, is going to the farmer's market and seeing like heirloom tomatoes in the summer or something.
I know, you know, that, you can pick
varieties.
The best one. We are
right?
up at our first
and
break.
And you never see them in the grocery store. Okay.
Simran, hold that thought. When we come back, we'll mm-hmm. be tasting heirloom tomatoes. Everybody stay with us. So much more. Wine, beer, bread. You're going to want to hear it all. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and SpeakUp networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy, darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We are so fortunate to have with us for this hour Simran Sethi. She is author of the award-winning book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Loss of Food We Love. And it's about the story of changes in food in agriculture told through bread, wine, chocolate, coffee, and beer. Is salacious a good word? I don't know. I was trying to come up with all these words that didn't sound sexual. Let's be honest. It's like it's sensual. And it sounds a little goofy, but I got carried away many times in the book. I'm writing down and making notes and putting yellow stickies on it and saying, we have to have this quote. So is this a perfect time to segue to another BAM and weave in the taste of tomatoes? If you eat an heirloom tomato at a farmer's market that's grown locally, I don't eat any other tomatoes because I can't. I try right. in restaurants, and then they kind of get stuck in my mouth, and I have to politely get them out of my mouth or swallow it in one piece. So that is the experience that you describe. And I want to do a quote from the book, okay?
Great.
Okay. Tasting is different from drinking and eating. Eating is an act of digestion. And this cracked me up. Lift to mouth, chew, swallow, process. And I'm thinking, isn't that what we all do? And I cracked up because I think most of us eat that way most of the time. And talk mm-hmm. to us about tasting and why is this almost a forgotten experience. And Simran, we do have those moments. I have them mostly with chocolate.
We do.
Where I put it in
yeah.
my mouth and I'm like, oh my God. Occasionally with wine, but if there's something you love, you know the difference between tasting and eating. What happened to us?
Well, I think it's like what happened to us with everything. You know that moment when you look
forward.
At your beloved,
yeah,
right? You know, you look at your beloved, and you're typically going through the motions, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I love that person. You know, you look at your kid, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm that child's mother. We don't live, you know, this like heightened state of kumbaya-ness all the time. But when it happens, we remember why we love what we love. And I just was trying to pull out and remind people that this does happen with food. I spent, you know, I work from home. I'm a writer. I spend a lot of time shoveling food into my mouth as if I've never, you know, read an etiquette book in my life. Like, it's just as if I were raised by wolves.
I get it. Yeah.
You know, there are moments that are so heightened and wonderful, and they don't have to be fancy foods. They certainly can be, but they can also be, you know, I describe like a diner in Bombay, India, eating yuca, which is like a starchy root vegetable out of a bucket in Havana, you know, that it's built upon the people you're with, the environment you're in. There's so many things that factor into something actually being experienced as delicious for us. But, you know, and this is our gateway. This is our tool to helping transform agricultural biodiversity. We ended the last segment with me talking about in-situ conservation on farm, which is farmers growing diverse foods. But guess what? The farmers can't grow it if we're not going to eat it. And we, the eaters, have so much power here to help reshape our food system. I mean, this is partly, you asked earlier, how did we end up here? Well, we ended up here because we have a lot of economic forces saying, let's standardize everything, let's process everything, let's make it cheap. And then we have governments saying, let's make it cheaper by subsidizing. And then we have people saying, okay, now it should take, you know, like 3 minutes to make a whole meal because we just pop it in the microwave, you know, or we just go and buy it from somewhere. We don't cook anymore. So this evolution has involved all of these entities, but that certainly includes us. And what it also means is that we can start to transform this again. And we can do this through taste. We can do this through savoring. And this is something that I am absolutely adamant about. This is not a book for foodies. This is a book for everyone who eats. This is a book for those of us who've ever had that delicious bam, aha, oh yes moment of putting something in our mouth and saying, like, this feeds me. This nourishes me. And I'll do a quick quote from the book. Taste is something we all do and all have. It doesn't just belong to foodies or sophisticates. Each of us owns and shapes this construct. What we feel about tasting and eating, what we savor, shouldn't be discriminatory or hierarchical. Because if we operate from the premise that only certain people own taste, then there's no point in exploring. We should all just frequent the places that have collected the most promising Yelp reviews or greatest number of Michelin stars. I refuse to do that. I refuse to let someone else define what delicious is for me. To whatever extent I can, I want to define and redefine what tastes good. I want to define what is good for me. And I want you to do the same for you, because taste is both universal and personal. What each and every one of us cherishes matters. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. There are tasting guides in every chapter for everyone to figure this out on their own, you know, for everyone to recognize if we're going to play a role in this, there's not one solution. It's deeply personal, and it's one that belongs to us.
And I just want to ask everybody who's listening, press pause here for a minute. And as Simran read that piece from the book, which I absolutely remember reading, is there any doubt that you want to read this book? It's like, give me more, tell me more. It's like crack. I just want to get on there and get in there, you know, and say, let's remember these forgotten experiences. And what about the aspects of who we are? Is our taste, is it a reflection of our culture, of how we were brought up, or the culture that we're experiencing now in the fast food capital of the world? What does taste tell us about us?
It tells us so much. That's what I love about food. It's identity, it's history, it's politics, it's economics. You know, we are what we eat. And
yes, I'm a chocolate bar.
There we go. You know, I mean, it says something about you, right? It says something. So chocolate, let's dissect chocolate for a second. Chocolate has more flavor compounds than wine. It's an extraordinary substance. It's 50% fat, right? The cocoa bean is 50% cocoa nib, so the kind of the chocolatey thing that we recognize, and it's 50% cocoa butter. And these are rough estimates. They vary loosely from bean to bean. But that means that it's stable at room temperature, but that fat will start to melt the minute it hits our mouth. So that means all those flavor compounds are released as the chocolate starts to melt. That says something about you. That says something about me, that this is a substance I love. It's not one that's going to, like, you know, hit you over the head in the first second. It's something that's going to release a little, you know, with a little time, over time. And it's something that, that comes from all these exotic places all over the world. Cocoa only grows in the thin belt around the equator. It's something that contains theobromine, and that is known for kind of perking us up, a little bit similar to caffeine, but it also contains anandamide, which is known for bringing us down. So it's kind of something that, like, wakes us up and chills us out at the same time. So for me, that makes it the perfect food. But it's very different from someone who starts the day with a Coke, right? It's very different from someone who prefers salty foods over sweet. Like, this all, these are all cues as to kind of how we were raised, the cultures that we were from. And I think as we move into a time where we do have so much fast food, I mean, you could even go to a McDonald's, like in you know, Europe or in India, and you would see regional foods on the menu. So they're even within that framework, we're still seeing a little bit of culture seeping in, you know? So I think it's not only that we are what we eat, but it's what my friend Jerome, who was the one of the executive chefs at Chez Panisse, a restaurant in Berkeley, California, said to me. He said, "We eat what we are." So I really at first thought he was kind of saying something kooky and, like, dismissed him. And more I realized we do. We eat the things that are anchors for us. We eat the things that trigger certain memories. We eat the things that remind us of our grandmothers. We eat the things that, that proclaim to the world that we're American, or we're Indian, or we're from, you know, New Mexico, or we're from New York. I mean, that there are, you know, we can plant a flag of identity with any one of these things. And that's also, I think, why it is so compelling to try to affect change through how we eat, because it isn't like changing a light bulb. You know, it is something that's really intimate to each of us, and something that we have a long relationship with.
And I want to build the bridge with that thought, that very profound, deep, exciting thought about we are what we eat what we are. There's an underpinning to this that you so artfully do, and it is because of these great, pleasurable, important, wonderful experiences, we have to be aware of the risk, because there is a lot of risk. And something I'd like to segue with, and I hope I can do this artfully and gracefully, when you were talking now, I had a bam moment. I think that I do know good chocolate, and that I can taste the difference, and that you, once you know it and you put a Hershey's Kiss in your mouth, you feel like you're chewing on wax. And to me, I'm not there with wine. So what you described to me with that I've experienced with chocolate, you know, for wine, at what point can you get there with wine? Because it does matter. It brings joy to my life. I don't know. I just say, oh, I don't know what it is. I just ask the person who knows the most to order my wine. I don't want to be that person. Yeah. I want to have the experience, the awakening about wine that I have had about chocolate. So how do we get there? What's going on in the glass?
Gosh, well, it's glass by glass, isn't it?
Yes.
The short answer is drink more wine, Gina. You know?
I like that.
But it doesn't, yeah, and it can be eat more kale. You know, if kale's your thing, drink more, you know, drink more juice. I mean, whatever it is that you love, it's like any relationship, right? The way you become better versed in the relationship and in that connection is by spending more time with the person, or by spending more time with the information, or with the food, or whatever it is.
Right.
So for me, I will say it's also uneven. I talk about bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer. I put beer in the book because beer is so democratic and extraordinary. Beer is basically just four ingredients. It's water, it's grain of any sort, you know, and it's yeast. It can have a fourth ingredient of hops, but it's made all over the world by all kinds of people. And it's something I didn't love. And I write in the beginning of that chapter, you know, that I had a post-it note above my writing desk that said, "Respect the beer."
I have that in my notes. Respect the beer.
And, you know, and I say this because you're asking me, like, how do I get to know wine better? And I'm going to say to you, I'm still learning, so I don't have an answer for you. I think what it takes is being present. I think what it takes is understanding that we show up with taste, like we're already tasting something before it ever reaches our mouth. In the wine chapter, I talk about, for example, a study that was done at Stanford University. So I want people to understand, like, taste isn't just something external, right?
Right.
It's not something that belongs to Yelp or Eater or Michelin or what have you. Like, we own it. And the way I think we can really own that is to understand what informs our experience of taste, which happens on the tongue, but also smell. So they combine kind of as flavor. Smell is the majority of what we experience. Like the flavors that we experience in food are really much more come from smell rather than the experience that we have through taste. But basically, you know, what I realized in writing the book is I'm still very much a student, and I was really struck by the study at Stanford. They found volunteers to go to lay down in MRIs in the machines, and they piped wine into their mouths. So these people were staying very still, and they were looking, you know, at their brain scans. And what they found was when people had been presented with an expensive bottle of wine, their brains got happy. You know, I mean, the reward response was triggered, right?
Right.
When
right.
they thought they were drinking cheap wine, the brain didn't have that same kind of response. Now, of course, the punchline is it was the same wine. But we do actually have a neurological response that is different when we perceive something to be different. When we perceive something to be expensive, we register it differently. You know, when we look at something, something is triggered. When we smell something, something is triggered. When we touch it, something is triggered. Sounds. I mean, there were people who were, researchers put headphones on them and then they made chips sound crisper, you know, so crunchier.
Yes, yes.
Well, they were stale chips. Well,
all of
but
those
when people
senses.
Heard the crunchy sound,
yes.
Exactly, when they heard the crunchy sound, you know, and you know, if we think of ourselves as like really feral beings, you know, navigating the world, our senses were there to protect us from ingesting poison. So everything was really engineered to allow us to live and thrive. And so I like to sometimes think about what that you know, prehistoric being was really like, and how when I receive a new food, how I want to experience it. And, you know, a lot of people are like skeptical about trying new things. And the truth is we are hardwired to resist change. As children, most of us display what researchers call food neophobia, which is like a rejection or a fear of new foods. But the interesting thing is that we transcend these fears by learning that they didn't kill us, right? So I
right.
ate the food and it
right.
didn't kill me. But also by exceptionalism. So we feel like, oh, well, I tried this one and it didn't kill me. But it's really ultimately the way we get over this fear is to keep trying and keep exploring and keep eating and imbibing new foods. So it's iterative. So the lesson is the more wines you try, the more you expand your palate, the more adept you'll be, not to be a wine expert, but to be your own wine expert.
And to know what you like.
And I think that's what's critical.
And that's what I'm starting
exactly.
to do. I write it down. I write the name of the wine
yeah.
down, and I see what's in it, because it is a wonderful experience for me, and it does help me relax, and it's fun socially. And I think it's great to tie it back to a case in point about the loss of the things we love. Tell us about your favorite, Trousseau Gris, isn't that what it was, with Caleb Taft? And your experience with that, that wine almost never made it to your lips.
Right. Well, it's so interesting because I love what you say about writing things down too. I think that's really critical. It helps really form that relationship in our mind, and you know, help us recall what it was. What one thing that really struck me, and then I'll answer your question, was that all the sensory experts I talked to, all the tasting experts I talked to, the one thing that really separates the rookies from the pros is they have a language for it. Of course they've studied. Of course they've consumed insane amounts of whatever the food or beverage is, but they also know how to put that into words. So I've included in the book tasting wheels so people
everybody
can find
has
their
to
words,
read those.
You know.
Everybody has to do the tasting sections.
We've all seen, you know, like a sommelier stick their nose into a glass and say something like honeysuckle, and you're like, I taste white wine, guy. Like,
right.
I don't know what you're talking about, you know? But he conjured it from somewhere, and maybe it's not in the front of my mind that these, you know, these grapes taste like honeysuckle or jasmine, but if I have those words in front of me, then I can start to say, oh, yeah, it does, you know what? It does taste a little floral. Well, what is that flower? Or it's fruity. Well, is it a stone fruit? Is it, you know, is it citrus? Like,
right,
where do
right.
we start? How do we orient ourselves? So when it comes to, so for me, it was the Trousseau Gris, right? The Trousseau Gris is, it's a wine that was, that is grown in one, commercially grown in one, on one 10-acre plot in California in the Russian River Valley. I wasn't writing a book on wine. I wasn't even writing a book on chocolate. I think at that point the book was like wheat, corn, you know, rice or potatoes. Like, it was probably not a book that you would have ever used sex language with, Gina, first
right.
of all. Okay.
Or felt like I was being, you know, there. Peeping Tom. It was pretty
right,
funny. Yeah.
Exactly. Me eating the potatoes. But it was the book, because those are dietary staples. Like, these are, to me, like, my life staples. It's like chocolate every day. You know, coffee sets the tone of every day of my adult life. You know, wine sets, you know, lets me down, whatever. But I thought I'd just sprinkle a little chocolate on top, you know, throw in a little wine for color. Like, I wasn't writing the book that you read. And I went, I'd done this interview in San Francisco with a chocolate maker, and I was doing a cleanse. I'd just come back from doing all this research in Italy. I didn't know it would be timed that way, that I'd end up in front of the chocolate maker. And chocolate is my thing. So I'd resisted chocolate, resist for hours. Very, very proud of myself. So I was like, well, I guess I'll go celebrate with a glass of wine. Which
Perfect.
Isn't really a cleanse item. Right. You know, it's not on anybody's dietary cleanse. But I was like, you know, it's not a big deal to me. So I can go have a glass of wine. Like, it's not, I don't feel like I'm breaking, you know, my little, like, diet.
Right,
so,
right.
I ordered, you know, I was in this kind of open mood. I'm usually pretty, like, type A about, like, ordering stuff and, like, I want what I want. And this woman, Allie, at this restaurant in Oakland called Camino, I just was, like, surprised me. And she brought me this glass that had this orange liquid inside of it. So already I was like, what is this beautiful glass? You know, this goblet full of sunset. And then I, you know, stick my nose in it, you know, don't really know what I'm doing, swish it around a little bit. I was like, huh, this smells peachy, but not like a Bartles and James wine cooler that I, like, started my drinking journey with. Like, it's a light peach, you know, I don't know. And then I drink it, you know, and it's just, it's like nothing I've ever tried. It's sweet, but not too sweet. It's got a little tinge of effervescence, so it's got, you know, just a little bit of a spark, but not like a champagne spark.
Okay, cliffhanger. Hold it, not like a spark. Cliffhanger.
Dot, dot, dot.
Everybody stay right here. If you want to hear the rest of this, we'll be right back with Simran Sethi. You won't want to miss one word.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for joining us. I know that you're glad you did, because this is an out-of-the-box, amazing, fun, exciting show. Our guest for this hour is Simran Sethi. She's a journalist and educator focused on food sustainability and social change and all other wonderful things that I don't want to take the time to share. I shared them in the top of the hour and at the first break. She's amazing. We know that. So let's go on with the cliffhanger and what happened with your experience with the grape that almost never made it to your mouth. And before we go start, because I know us,
yeah.
It's going to be the end, and I'm going to be saying, okay, part two.
Right.
But your book's coming out in paperback, and I think we should tell people that.
Yes.
That it's important.
Absolutely,
love the hardcover.
Delighted.
I love the feeling. Mm-hmm. I love to run my fingers over the front of the book, the texture. I love to see that little red wine ring. But paperback's fine if you want that. So yeah, go ahead and get paperback. It's not going to be the same experience, but you will have it. So let's go on with that.
It's easier to carry around.
It is. Whatever.
The paperback
it's worth
is now. By the
it.
Time you hear this, yes, the paperback is out. So you can make this investment knowing that, you know, it'll be a little bit lighter in your bag and a little bit lighter in your wallet. So I hope that everyone will find that at their favorite retailer.
They should buy two. If it's in paperback, they should buy two, because there's somebody, some girlfriend especially, or some really great, highly evolved Renaissance man that you're going to want to share this with. You are going to want to share this book with people. Yes.
Oh. Thank you. We're going to get back to the wine, but let me just say, I wrote this book for women. And I wrote this book for women because women are the people who grow most of the food that we eat. Women make up the majority of smallholder farmers throughout the world.
And they buy
women
most
are the ones
the
who
food.
Make exactly. They make the purchasing decisions inside of the home. Like, we are the ones who hold the keys to this transformation and to really helping reshape our food system. And I, you know, I just had this particular woman in mind. You know, I started writing this book in Lawrence, Kansas, and it's just, it's for everyone. It's for the woman who just wants to knock back on the weekend with her girlfriends and enjoy a glass of wine. Like, it's just, I want you to enjoy it more, and I want you to know why enjoying that wine matters.
Right.
And so that's what gets us back to the Trousseau Gris. So there I am, this little peach goblet in my hand. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm looking at or
tasting. You're swishing it around in
your
mouth.
I'm not even tasting, right? Exactly. So we've got that little effervescence going, and it's also, it has this great mineral quality. So it feels, I mean, I talk in the book about, like, the kinds of flavors that you taste. For me, this was like a slate. It was like rocks. It was like earth. It was so wonderful. And I wanted to know more. And that had never happened to me before with wine. Some people have that in craft beer. You know, that moment where they're like, wow, this is why it's different than a Budweiser, you know?
Yes.
Or they have it with coffee. You know, the specialty coffee movement is off the hook right now. This doesn't have to be an expensive foray. This can be as simple as going down to your favorite brewery and ordering that beer instead of picking up the industrial six-pack. This can be choosing the nicer craft chocolate. This can be, you know, picking that bottle of wine or that glass of wine, in my case, you know, that I hadn't heard of before. And what I learned about that wine was it's only grown on a 10-acre plot in the Russian River Valley in California. We can grow a number. California is extraordinary. We can grow a number of different varieties of wine grapes. However, we only grow like less than 10. Why is that? Because this industrialized system, you know, is moving us toward that point, right? And is reducing that diversity. And the gentleman who's growing that wine is he's like the polar opposite of me. He's someone who, you know, is very conservative in every aspect of the word. Yet he is the one who saved my wine. And I feel like, again, this is a way that people are knit together. We're not the same. We're not the same politically. You know, we're not the same genders. We're not the same ethnicities or races. But we all eat. This is a universal. And we can come together and work together to really savor and save the foods that we love. And it happens through something as innocuous as saying yes to something unfamiliar on a menu, going to the farmer's market and saying, what is that? How do I cook it? Let me try it out. You know, and that's where it begins. That's how we help support this web and this shift towards increased agricultural biodiversity. So for me, it started with the wine. And what happened was I realized then that there was such a compelling story there that I shifted the entire book. So my sister likes to say, like, oh, now you're writing a book telling people to eat everything that like everybody tells them not to eat. I was like, well, yes, I am. Go for it.
But
you know,
not really.
Eat, here's the thing.
But not really. Not
but
really.
Good stuff. Yeah, you're right.
Not really.
You're
it's
right.
About eating what you're going to eat, making sure you know that you're tasting it instead of eating it, that you're savoring it instead of shoving it down, that you're sipping it instead of gulping it. It's about the experience of eating and then taking it to a deeper level when you can and saying, we need to preserve so much of this so that our next generations have it and so that they can have their special wine experience. Okay.
Go ahead.
We have got to, this is like I'm having angst because there are so many things I want to cover on this show. And you know what? I knew this was going to happen. I knew it because
yeah,
I want to hear
know.
Every word of what you have to say, but we cannot go off the air without you talking
mm-hmm.
about chocolate and the baba. Mm-hmm. You have to talk about mm-hmm. the baba. And this is what I wrote mm-hmm. in my notes. When I was reading this, it did almost feel, I'm going to be honest here, I've never said this on the air, like I was observing an orgy of some sort. Help me out here. And can you do the best you can to describe what happened to you at the Alberto Bautista farm? I was almost going like, oh my God, oh my God, when you're talking about the baba, and I'm cracking up. Thank God nobody was in the room with me. So talk all you want about chocolate. You can take the rest of the show to talk about chocolate, and we'll do another show about beer and bread. We'll call it the Beer and Bread Show because
there we
I
go.
Care the most
I'm
about this.
After my own heart. Yes, none of it, I'll read to you, none of it was what I expected. Not the smell of damp earth, not the sight of scentless white blossoms the size of my fingernail, or pods the length of my forearm, astonishing grooved footballs in green, yellow, orange, red, and purple growing straight out of tree trunks, not the sound of the pods thudding to the ground with a swift jab of the palanca, a sharp blade on an extended wooden pole that stabs at the small expanse between the pod stem and trunk, or the sound of pods cracking open with the whoosh of a machete or hard strike against tree, not the warm, sticky flesh.
Here comes.
I hadn't fully conceived of what a chocolate forest would look like, but it wasn't this, a fantastical Dr. Seuss dream made manifest. The pulp inside the fruit, the flesh covering the seeds, is warm, sticky, and sweet. However, cacao is harvested not for the flesh, but for the seeds that we mistakenly refer to as beans. Those seeds, once processed, are what become cocoa and chocolate. And chocolate, as we well know, is a miracle substance. Chocolate was so transformative for me, Gina, because it was unrecognizable to me in nature. I haven't eaten any chocolate. I'm 45 years old. I've been eating it for at least 40 years.
Right.
And, you know, if someone had said to me, like, where does it come from? I'm like, oh, gosh, I don't know. Is this the sap of a tree?
It's like, and what I wrote here is my personal advice to all of you chocolate lovers and wannabe chocolate lovers, get the book, read the chapter on tasting chocolate, and fall in love all over again. Is there anything you want to add to that, Simran? It's like, this is what you fall in love all over again. And I think you should touch on the challenges, the deck being stacked against small farmers, the small manufacturer.
Right, right.
Are there glimmers of hope that you saw in this journey? Preserve our chocolate, Simran. It's your responsibility.
I will do my best.
No pressure.
And, you know, the good news is, in January, I'm going to have my own podcast, The Slow Melt, that focuses exclusively on cacao, cocoa, and chocolate.
Yes.
So you're going to have a chance to learn more then. What I will say in brief is the most important thing for me is that people recognize that small farmers from developing countries are the ones that are making chocolate happen. Chocolate is a fruit. It comes from a tree. It is grown by small farmers, most of whom live in West Africa, in Ivory Coast, and in Ghana. And it's critically important that people remember that chocolate isn't a substance born in Switzerland or Belgium or from Hershey's. It's made into the product there, right? But it starts with these, honestly, many of whom are really poor subsistence farmers. So if we go from there, I think, and we start to look toward the manufacturers or the makers that are really trying to support those small farmers, we come up with a different kind of equation. If you think that when you spend 99 cents on a candy bar that like a farmer is making enough to live on, you're mistaken, right? About 3-6% of every dollar we spend goes back to the farmer. So the lion's share of it goes to the manufacturer. So they're the people who turn, you know, this seed that I was referencing into the chocolate that we love. Of course they should make money for that, but they make the lion's share of that money. And you know, they're really transforming landscapes. They're transforming in good ways and in bad farmers' lives. And there's so much information out there. There's been an explosion around chocolate in the last year. I would encourage people to really start to look at some of the issues behind their chocolate. Who harvested that chocolate? Was it children? Where does it come from? Were they paid a fair wage? I mean, there's a number of ways for people to get involved in this. And I feel like chocolate is one of those amazing gateway substances because it is something that we love. We love for our whole lives. I had to learn to love wine. I had to learn to love beer and coffee. I was born loving chocolate.
Yeah, I showed up the first day I popped out. I was a chocolate lover. And
exactly.
It's in our DNA. My mother was a chocoholic. I am. Mm-hmm. My daughter, one of my daughters in particular is. And then it has been fun to watch my grandchildren, who are just like us.
Wow.
In Taos, New Mexico, I have to tell you this. I was so excited to tell you this. There is I will not say it right, but like a chocolate, say it in French for me, because you speak
chocolatier?
French.
Chocolatier?
Yes.
Like a chocolatier?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And you go in, and you get these little nibs, these little dabs, mm-hmm. They have hot chocolate and a mousse, but you can taste all different kinds of chocolate that their family has gotten from places, I believe, in South America. And you go in, and there are little tastings on your plate. I put it up on my Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get to savor it. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that, but it gives me hope. And let's just talk for a minute about, it's really important to me that you emphasize this for our listeners. spend some extra money. You might spend $6 on a latte that doesn't have nearly the experience for you. Spend $2 or $3 on a piece of chocolate. I mean, truffles in this place where I go in New Mexico, it's $2.50. You don't just woof it down and put it in your mouth. You take little bites, you experience it, and you have this whole, you know, foodgasmic opportunity for tasting what you're putting in your mouth.
Well, and you know, price is can be an important signal. Not all chocolates are made alike. We use these words as singulars: coffee, chocolate, beer. We know, look at beer or wine. We know they're multiple, like truth, right? Like that there's not one variety of wine. When you say I like wine, it's like, well, which kind? You know, when you say I love beer, well, what do you like? Something hoppy, a stout? That's the same kind of diversity exists in all foods if we allow it.
Whether
it's a tomato or a chocolate, they all come from someplace. They all have what we call terroir, the taste of place, the soil, the climate, the hands that process it, the way that they're processed. Every food I talk about is a fermented food. Who knew chocolate was fermented? Well, I didn't 5 years ago. You know, all these things impact how the flavor is at the end of the process. When it comes to industrialized foods, the Hershey bar, the Bud Light, whatever it is, it's engineered to be the same. But what I want people to embrace is the difference. And when we do that, we have a completely different experience of the food. And that is one that that is worth investing in. The people who work so hard to harvest the best cacao, to grow the best hops, to, you know, cultivate the best grains, like, they should be rewarded, you know? What Barrio Bread is doing in Tucson, what Don is doing with his bread shouldn't be the same as, like, Wonder Bread. You know what I mean? Like, they're not the same thing. So we shouldn't pay the same, and we shouldn't expect to pay the same for those items.
No, and people stand in line. This is what's encouraging to me.
Yeah,
people stand
they
in line.
Should. I would be one of them.
Yeah,
if
we
I
have to order it by, like, he opens it up for ordering at 7 o'clock on the morning of on Friday. And if you don't get on by 7, I'm not kidding, 7:05, most of what you want is gone. So I'll call him with the whiny voice and say, Don, I tried to get on at 7:05 and I wanted this. Are you going to have any extra? And then I say, I promise I'm not going to call you anymore. And then he goes, you know,
this is Green pulling rank.
Yeah, pulling rank, like whining. I get the whiny voice. Two really quick things. And I'm kind of sad because there's so much more here. But maybe what I should think about is that anyone who listens to this show will go and get the book. I encourage you to go to your local bookstore. You can get it on Amazon, but make it an intentional experience and go get it from a locally owned bookstore and buy a piece of really good, fair trade, ethically sourced good chocolate and realize that you're starting the experience. If we could, let's take the time to end on Three Hearts. By sharing stories, we become a part of them. This is the end of your book. You shared so many stories. You shared them so beautifully. And why don't we end on this beautiful note by your sharing the powerful message that you received from the Blue Heart of the Ocean herself, Sylvia Earle, who has been a guest on my show. Let's end with hope and possibility and excitement.
Absolutely. Sylvia is an icon. And when I first, you know, learned about the you know, over-harvesting of our oceans, 90% depleted, you know, I leaned into her and I just was like wringing my hands and saying, 90% of our fish stocks are depleted. And she said, the 10%, and that's it. Like, we're not done yet. It's not time to give up. It's time to eat better. It's time to think about where our food comes from. And it's time to work together to feast on our lives and to save by savoring.
And to look at that and to think about hope, because I'll tell you, kiddo, there are times when I get off a show and I put my head down on the desk and I'm like, we're screwed. We're totally screwed. Mm-hmm. We have no choice. Ways to get in touch with you, I think we should cover that. SimranSethi.com is a great way to find out about you. Your Facebook page. Is it, do I have it right? Is it
So, you know, the best way, P. Simran Sethi, but the most information I share comes on Twitter and on Instagram, and that's just at Simran Sethi, SimranSethi. So, or through my website.
And
but
you really want to look at your Instagram.
Get to really be on my journey. Yeah, my journey shows up on Instagram.
And I look at it and I'm like, I will never be this creative. You come up with these little vignettes, and I want to be in there. And I'm like, can I come over? And what are our chances? We're working hard. I've submitted your name to the Tucson Festival of Books. They just sent out the questionnaire if we wanted to chair a panel, which I do. I would love to be a facilitator for that. So I hope we're coming out here. And let's just add, what's next? You can never write another book like this. I am telling you, you can never.
What's next?
There's got to be lots next for Simran Sethi.
Gosh, yes. I'll be speaking in Vancouver. I will be in France. I will be in New York. I'll be in San Francisco. I'm doing a lot of chitter chatter around the book. You can find that on the website. And then I think the Slow Melt, which is my upcoming podcast on chocolate,
it's
will
like
really
next week.
Probably
that's what it feels
inspire.
Like.
It'll
next
inspire
week.
A book. You know, I think that's what I'm meant to write next, is really focusing on the food of the gods, which is what Theobroma cacao is. So so I think that's what you'll find in print next
And you'll
go
be
around.
Here with us, and I'm sure we'll stay connected. I know you have
absolutely
friends here. Jim and Dee are wonderful, and that's how I got to meet you. I feel very blessed.
Yes.
And their restaurant, Sine, is doing great. It's doing
it's
fabulously.
Delicious. It
yes,
should be.
It's really delicious. I mean, somebody was complaining to me the other day that they went in there, and they, you know, it's relatively new, and she said, and they said the next opening was 9:30. Just like, and in Tucson,
wow.
That's not really the most popular dining hour. We're getting better
no.
at having places open till 1 o'clock. But anyway, I hope that we have you here in March and maybe be able to do the second part of the interview where we can talk about beer and bread. This was delightful, fun, informative, exciting. Next week, another great show. Susan Yao, Habitat for Humanity International, and what they are doing to end homelessness around the world. It was surprising, shocking, and inspiring to me. Simran, you are the bam. Thanks for being a part of the show.
My great pleasure. Thanks to all of you.